It's Wednesday, October 24th, 2012, and you're listening to episode 281 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 2 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
This is Julia.
This is John.
And joining us today, we've got a guest host, Greg Christopher.
How's it going?
Pretty good. And Greg, we'll give you a chance here to introduce yourself and explain why you're on the show in a minute. But there's two things I got to get out of the way first. One is that the postcards contest is still going on. Once again, for anyone who's not been following that, all you have to do is take a postcard, write it in character as if you were in a dungeon. This can be any kind of dungeon, a space hulk, a castle, whatever. Write it in the first person as if you're down there, you know, I wish you were her sort of thing. Mail it to an address that we provided. And what we are going to do is we are going to go across the shows in our little non-network network, which is Fear the Boot, both Kicked in the Dice Bag Show, Established Facts, Postcards from the Dungeon. We're going to pick out five top winners. Each of those five winners will get a free pick of a gaming product. The grand prize winner will get an additional three picks for four total picks. And on top of that, we have just been given a new prize. Jim Pinto has agreed to throw in a signed copy of The Ultimate Toolbox. And for anyone who's not familiar with that, it is an RPG book that consists of nothing but basically inspiration, random charts and whatnot for generating things like plots, setting, characters. It is not rule specific.
It's the internet in a book.
Yeah, it's got nothing to do with like new spells or new weapons. It's not that sort of book. It's the sort of book that you can use to grab as a game master, as a player, to real quickly assemble the softer ideas. And on top of that, Jim is also throwing in a copy of The World's Largest Dungeon. So if you come out as a grand prize winner, you've got two things from Jim Pinto and four things you pick yourself. This has got to be worth the cost of a postcard for you to do. So I will link it again in the show notes. And on top of that, we are also, just to give you guys a little more time since we've just changed up the prizes, we are pushing back the due date for these postcards to November 10th. So that will give you about another week and a half to get those postcards into us.
You know, I really want to go through The World's Largest Dungeon with Johan. Think about how much fun that would be.
You, me, and Johan would be like wrecking crew.
I still want to do The Sum of Undermountain. I've done parts of it. I want to do the whole thing.
I've never done any of it.
Yeah, neither have I.
I'll run it. I'll run the whole damn thing. That's our next campaign. And we'll do it online. How do we do a good online game? Greg Christopher.
Well, we'll get to that. That is today's main topic.
I actually ran Undermountain within the past 3 weeks.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, you can't. Second possibly, edition.
Well, wow. You can tell me you started running it or finished running.
Oh no, I didn't finish it. Yeah. No, it was. We're testing out a actual adjudication system, so rather than the actual module.
Isn't Undermountain like meant to take you from level 1 to 20
yeah,
or something
yeah.
to that effect? Yeah. It's just some. Yeah, you.
Well, in a level parity system, it's meant to take you from 1 to 20. I think in second edition, your rogue gets to 20 and your wizard gets to 10.
Well, okay, fair enough. The point being,
I'm sorry, you're a thief. There are no rogues in second.
The point being, we'll come back to online gaming here in a minute. We do have something more pressing we need to talk about. I guess it's kind of a PSA. There's a lot of scary things in the world that people need to be aware of, and a lot of stuff going on that, you know, if you're not following geopolitics or the upcoming election, there's some one thing in particular, at least, you need to be aware of, because it is a threat to all of us. I don't think there's a person listening to the show who has not been touched by this. Certainly not an American child.
Pat. Honey Boo Boo.
Oh,
you know, I started saying Pat before you gave the kid one. Now it's ruined.
What I am referring to is not Pat, but the Martians on Sesame Street.
Ah, the Yib Yibs. The origin of XCOM, the most terrible Xeno, worse than an ethereal, it's the Yib Yibs.
You sit there on Overwatch on your bed waiting for the closet door to open.
Yes, and all you can say is, nope.
Nope. Cow. Is there anyone on this right now on the mics who did not have their freaked out by those things?
Oh no, those were creepy.
Yeah, they were really creepy. After I got older, I was okay with them.
I had nightmares about them. All jokes aside, I had nightmares about them.
I never had nightmares about them, but they were creepy.
Even though I watched Sesame Street,
they were. I'll post a link to them in the show notes for anyone who can't remember them or didn't have access to.
Or wants to see something that's scarier than The Exorcist.
Yeah, or just did not have access to PBS when they were growing up. But the little creatures we're talking about, They were kind of like these, I don't know, these like the fuzzy cylinders that had a whole lot of yarn-like appendages that came down off of them.
And like a ball for a mouth.
Yeah, like a ball for a mouth. And they would show up. They would, I mean, you hear like a flying saucer land. They would come out and they'd start going, mum, 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 mum. And then they would find somebody's house and they just go into the house and nobody was home and like the phone would ring and like freak out like I start going all nuts and be like ring phone. I mean, it
was creepy.
I mean, these things are the absolute outcropping of an insane mind. I don't know who they found to do this. It was like Joseph Mengele's son or something came up.
After all this time, I think we're finally seeing where Dan's human supremacist came from.
Why,
it was being scared by Yip Yips.
You know that there's a shirt Day now that says Yip Yip all down it with them on it.
No.
I'm going to have to get you that
I would
now.
Shoot somebody. I mean, if I saw somebody in the state of Missouri, that would probably count as that would probably count as a genuine threat to my person and property, and I would have to kill the person.
Yeah, one of my really good friends owns one, and he wears it, and it's hilarious. I don't think he was freaked out by him, though. I don't know. I've never had that conversation.
The other Sesame Street episode that freaked me out, did you see the one where they were in Egypt?
No, I don't remember.
There was a Sesame Street episode where Bert and Ernie were in Egypt, and Bert was all excited, and so he was like running around looking at all the different Egyptian artifacts or whatever. And Ernie is standing by the statue. And every time Bert would leave, the statue would come to life and start talking and singing to him. And Ernie would, of course, freak out. And as soon as Bert came back, the statue would immediately resume its original pose. And it just, like, kept doing this to him over and over. That was another one that, like, I wish Carla was here because I'd call her onto the mics to agree with me on this.
So it was the Michigan J. Frog of statues.
Kind of, yes, except it was like this undead statue thing. It was really disturbing to a child. I mean, as an adult, it's not that big a deal.
Statues aren't creepy until you've watched Doctor Who.
That's what it was, though.
Statues are creepy.
That's what it was. It was weeping angels, except they're doing it to like 4-year-olds. That's not right.
Some of the creepiest stuff has been when I had two young kids and watching this crazy stuff now as an adult. And you're like, whoa, I didn't even notice how freaky this was when I was 7. There's stuff in Mickey Mouse's Gift of the Magi where he's working for an employer that beats him and forces him to do unethical things and steal people's money. Like, wow, this is a great message.
So he's in law.
He's in corporate America anywhere. Yeah. Having a job is the new raise. I just saw that on Facebook today. Saw a lot of things on Facebook today. Most of them I won't repeat because most of them are stupid. That one was the least amusing. All right, so let's get to what we're going to talk about here. Greg, why don't you introduce yourself? And then I want to explain, apart from all the many virtues you have, which one of the virtues motivated me to say we need to get Greg Christopher on the show. So go ahead and fire away.
I used to be a blogger, but when I switched over to Google+, I don't do that very much anymore. But I have a very prolific posting strategy on Google+. There's a lot of people that follow me, and we have RPG discussions every day, discussions about game design and play and how to make different things happen at the table. I use Google+ as a platform to run a lot of online games, playtesting work that I've created, playing other people's stuff, new games I've never played before. And in the past 2 to 3 years, I've written about 7 free games. These are fully playable RPGs, starting out a long time ago with like a universal system, and I've gone through several different iterations. I have a heist game, a classic medieval fantasy game, a post-apocalypse sci-fi game, all sorts of stuff that each time I've worked on different aspects of game design and building different things, so try to get better over time. And a lot of people think that they're a woodworker and they just only build tables. I try to build, you know, spread out, build different types of things rather than always focusing on the same niche. And people get kind of typecast in a way into what they make. And I just tried to spread out and do a lot of creative stuff and for free right now because I'm, you know, building up my skill set.
And I will absolutely go on record saying that Greg does keep a very consistent blog, both in terms of release schedule and in terms of the quality and variety of the content. I realize I'm calling it a blog and it's more of a Google+ feed. I will link to that in the show notes. If you are interested in checking out his stuff, you will know where to find him. I read some of your work. To be honest, the only reason I don't read more of it, and you are, by the way, the only internet RPG blogger that I read, the only only reason that I don't read more of your stuff is because of the fact that I exist in a perpetual state of information overload.
I understand.
So with these other RPGs, now that's not what we have you on here for, but with these other RPGs, just out of curiosity, I mean, how long are these? Are they like one pagers, like, you know, Stuart Robertson type things?
200-page, the first one, the big universal system called Synapse. Most of them are between 80 and 120 pages. Full scale, try to keep them rules light, be comparable to original D&D or that kind of level of system in terms of complexity. For reasons when we get into the main discussion, I'll talk about the virtues of that. I'm in an online environment, but I try not to get into anything that looks like Pathfinder or 3.5 because there's just too much complexity there for my taste. But these are full scale RPGs, yeah.
And that's why we wanted you on the show, is to bash D20. So,
hey, now. I happen to like
D20. It's only way, you know, I could pull out World of Darkness if we want to talk about the problems with that, but it's just that's what sprung to mind.
Well, no, what we did have you on the show for is a conversation popped up, and you're going to have to help me get the specifics right, where I was talking about not getting exactly what I want out of games or something to that effect. And you linked me in a post, as best as I recall, and said we could do this in an online game or something like that. And the reason that I wanted to get you on the show is because I retorted back the things that we have said and indeed experienced many times throughout the course of doing the show, which is that online games are fraught with problems. It's very hard to get people to stay invested, to keep showing up. Once they are there, it's hard to keep them from alt-tabbing or jacking around with spouse, kids, dinner, whatever. People just don't seem to take them as seriously. You lose some face-to-face interaction, so on and so forth.
In fairness, we're on episode, like, what, 182?
281.
Wayne was 100 episodes.
Whatever.
I didn't know you've been on the show.
I wasn't on for the first 100 episodes.
True. Okay.
I just want to point out that out of those, we've had two episodes where we've talked about online gaming and its concerns, but there were, what, 279 dedicated to the problems of tabletops. I'm just saying.
The reason why I said the comment recently is because, like, the past five or six episodes of the show have been about these problems that you guys have had in terms of people getting the games that they want, making the different pitches, all sorts of stuff like that, all those things. And I'm sitting there listening going, this is not a problem at all. I don't know why you guys have this problem.
See, I think Wayne and Greg both, the reason that we have dedicated so much talk time to tabletop gaming is the fact that there, I guess I see the problems as existent, but tractable. They can be dealt with. I've developed strategies for dealing with them. Yeah, there's a few topics
like
there's a few topics where I just kind of throw up my hands and say, I have no idea what you do here. But with most topics, I can come up with some approach. But so what unfolds here, as Greg and I are talking to Google Plus, well, I'm not into online gaming because of this problem and this problem and this problem. And every single ball that I'm tossing your direction, you just knock out of the park. And I mean, you didn't just give me so-so answers, because I've heard plenty of so-so answers. You actually had legitimate, plausible, substantive ways of answering each of those. And I'm like, okay, apparently this is just a subject that I don't get, but somebody else does. So we need to get this person on the show to deal with this topic, one, because there is a growing community of online players who deserve some love and some advice. And secondly, because as we said many times throughout the history of Fear the Boot, I know for a fact there are a lot of people that don't have a group because they had a falling out with their group. Everybody grew up and had kids. They live in a farming community where they can't find anyone. They live in a country where role playing's not all that common. And so they're looking for something like an online game, but they don't know how to find one and don't know how to make it work. And so, Chris, I wanted to bring you on this show to reconstruct what you did for me. So where do you want to start this?
First, let's talk about the good sides to not actually being in the physical place. Those are some things that you guys have touched on in the show before as being big problems, and they're totally non-problems when you get out. So if these are big problems at your table, and you can move to an online environment, and they're not a problem for you anymore. The first one is something that Chris Hussey's talked about a ton on the show, the temptation to overeat, overconsume at the table. When you have a lot of people together, you have somebody brings out cookies or brownies or cheese balls, whatever, and people want to eat it. They feel they need to have two or three Mountain Dews or whatever it is that they're eating at the table. And if you're in an online environment, that temptation is really not there.
We're looking at you, Julia, and your tray of tempting brownies that you brought.
Hey, at least they're not alcoholic cupcakes like normal.
Don't worry, we'll balance it out with a little bit of blow later.
Yeah.
So I've noticed this too.
Why are you looking at me, Dan?
It's a calorie burner.
It's your turn.
Lawyer.
So I've noticed this too with when I'm together with a big group of people, everyone always brings the junk food. And even if you're trying to do healthier junk food, you're still snacking through the whole time.
Yeah.
When I'm gaming online, I don't really have that urge like I do when I'm sitting around, everyone else is eating too.
You want to know why, at least for me? Because I am equally impulsive and lazy. When I'm sitting at a table and there are snacks piled all over it, I'm going to eat them because they're there. When I'm on my ass, either sitting in bed or sitting on the couch with a computer in my lap and one or more animals sleeping on top of me, do you think I'm going to get up to go get anything? I mean, I could be bleeding out and I'm just going to staunch it using the couch cushions.
Well, the difference too is because I'm at my own house, I have my own food in there. So it's not out of the ordinary for me to be eating dinner in the background while I'm playing an online game, because I can do that without it being the same distraction that it would be at the table.
And the real difference is that six of your friends aren't around you also eating chips.
Exactly.
Guess what? That's going to make you eat chips.
Yeah.
I'm opposite. I hate eating at the table. I really do. It's too much crap around me. I guess I just have to push it all away. I don't know. I like my dice, my paper, my pencil, and that's it.
Chris, another one that you talked about in our conversation.
Greg.
Don't worry. Everybody calls me Chris all the time.
Well, this is what you get for having two first names as your full name.
It's Greg Chris?
Greg Christopher.
Oh.
I chose to let my children take my wife's name and never have to deal with these problems ever again.
So Greg, one of the other things that you brought up in our conversation is travel.
Yeah. That's probably a lot of the reason why people are eating dinner at the table is because they had to leave work, drive over there. They didn't have enough time to stop and eat. Right. So I used to eat dinner at the table.
You're in a place where the roads get iced over or snowed over. Your car breaks down.
Oh, yeah, that too.
You've got someone who maybe based on age doesn't have a driver's license. Maybe because of an income situation doesn't have a car or doesn't have the capacity to pay for gas to travel.
The worst part of gaming right now is as soon as it's over, I've got the 45-minute drive home.
Right. Yep,
you know, when we were hosting at my house for a while, it was great because I could go upstairs.
Yeah.
For Pat, I've talked to him. It's great for him because he can just go upstairs. But when you have that drive ahead of you, it's like as soon as gaming's over, it's like, oh.
Everything we do is so far west of town proper. We have to drive afterwards for half an hour to 45 minutes.
I have the same thing after podcasting. Yeah. As soon as the podcast is over, I'm like, now I have to drive all the way home.
Yep.
When you're the only one on the road and the cop's going to pull you over.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, then you can't drink either. At least at home, you can.
Yeah. You can juggle around, you know, designating sober drivers if you really want to get schlocked on podcast night, which, you know, sometimes, but.
Or just carry John's business card.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you want to walk, don't talk.
Exactly.
And if you want to go, don't blow.
It's better to be judged by 12 than carried by 6.
Yep. We give great legal advice on this show. All right. So go on, Greg. What are some of the other virtues that you think a remote game has over a tabletop game? And then we'll move from that into what my concerns have historically been with remote gaming.
You can be in a comfortable surrounding of your choice. Whenever I get in a group with a bunch of people in the same room, it gets hot. People get sweaty and tired. They're sitting on chairs they don't want to sit on that are hard or uncomfortable, or they're on a bench or the couches aren't arranged around properly. People are disconnected from the group because of the way the seating is set up. That's not a problem.
All you're doing is encouraging us to terminate the podcast.
We're looking at each other like, yeah.
It's like, yeah, the room gets too hot. We're on uncomfortable chairs.
See, my group has the opposite problem with me where I'm always freezing and I'm like, I need a blanket. So basically, we give me a blanket. I'm sitting there all old womaned. It's really sad. So I'm like cold right now and you guys are all probably
I have
hot.
Blankets and a Snuggie, so whatever you need, we
got. The last thing kind of dovetails with that being that you can play at whatever time is convenient for you. My best time is from about 9 o'clock to midnight, maybe a little bit after midnight. And I can set up a game at that time. As soon as I turn off the computer, I can go walk right over and get in my bed. I don't have to drive. I don't have to do anything like that. So it's very convenient. My kids are already in bed because of all that, when I used to have game night in real life, I would have to be away from my kids during dinner because I had to drive over to the game. Then I'd be home late after everybody was in bed and my dog would freak out when I walked in the house. None of that occurs. It's at a time that's convenient for me and everything set up the way that I want, creature comfort wise.
That is certainly one of the things that attracts me to the idea of online gaming. Is generally speaking, you are fishing from a much broader pool. If I am going to game with people locally, I have to find folks that are available at the same dates and times. You know, we have to make sure our schedules line up. We have to be able to go to the same location. We have to agree on a system. We have to agree on a style or compromise on system, style, etc. And we have a much more limited group of people to draw from because it's only people that we know who are local and close enough and available enough to do all these things. And so we may be, quite frankly, gaming with every single person we know that fits the bill. Or maybe at best, well, we're mostly gaming with all the people we know and can game with. Maybe there's a handful more we could pull if we wanted to, but overall, we're somewhat restricted. If you go to online gaming, suddenly that pool opens wide up. I mean, you have as many people as there are available gamers on the internet, up to including people that are maybe only available at weird hours. For example, yeah. I'm a night owl. I've mentioned this on the show before. I have pretty severe insomnia. I will fall asleep most nights between 4 and 6 in the morning and typically wake up sometime in the afternoon. Now, for an American gaming group, that's going to be somewhat problematic.
Australians and New Zealanders are up. They're ready to play with you, buddy.
And depending on what day of the week it is, Europeans may be, you know, by the time I'm up and ready to go, they're home from work and starting their game or whatever the case may be. And so,
I guess for me, I've never seen that as the huge advantage to it, because when I want a game, I want a game with people that I already know and I'm already friends with.
Yeah, I agree.
Which in my case, that may be people that aren't local. When I have that online gaming, are people that I'm already friends with, but they're not anywhere near me. So it wasn't a matter of there's just a bigger pool for me. It was a matter of I have no other way to game with these people unless I do it online.
Well, yeah, if I wanted to game with you guys, I can't fly out to St. Louis.
Well, I'd like to bring up the fact that with the wider pool, you also have more people who are interested in the game system you want to play. I don't know how many times our group of friends are like picking game systems and somebody really wants to play something, but nobody wants to run it. You might be able to find it online. So I could definitely see an advantage there.
I usually have the reverse. I want to run something. Can't find anyone to play it.
Oh, yeah. We have the opposite.
I'll pitch out a campaign idea. This group will shoot it down. And then I'll get half a dozen PMs on the forums or whatever. That sounds awesome. I will hope you'll run that game someday. And I'll be like, yeah, maybe I should.
It's one of those things where there's a lot of potential for me to game with people that I'm friends with that aren't local, but I run into the same issues that I have with local games of you've still got to get around everyone's schedule because I'm not going to strangers to try to put together the games. Right. I don't have all of the advantages that Chris... Now you got me doing it, Dan. I don't have all the advantages that Greg's talking about when I've done online gaming. I just get the advantage of getting to play with my friends that I wouldn't get to otherwise, which is a pretty big advantage.
You know, actually, on my little note page right here, I just wrote Greg and circled it. So hopefully you've seen that. Stop doing that.
Yeah, when I do play online, I don't play with strangers, but I do play with three people who live in Philadelphia, one who lives in Kentucky, and one who lives in Oregon. So obviously you need the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Goblins game I played in was that way. I think you and I were the only two in St. Louis or the St. Louis Metro.
Those were the three Philly people and the one Oregon person.
Yeah.
So there's really two issues here. One is that you can get that game that you wanted to play. You've always wanted to play Dark Ages Vampire, but nobody would ever play with you in your game group. You can just set up that group and recruit people fresh. And when that's done, it disbands and disappears. Unlike in real life where you feel like you're really committed to this group forever. And when the game's over, you have to play another game with those same people. That expectation is gone.
One of the things that I certainly think is not an issue, and I want to revisit this only because of the fact that I think a lot has changed since the last time we talked about it, is the availability of online tools. I mean, if you go back to the days of like the BBSs or the early internet with like AOL and whatnot, there were a lot of hurdles to playing online because you'd have to declare actions, handle die rolls separately, trust each other with character sheets, whatever. But now
you could use your AOL 3.0 profile as a character sheet.
I'm not saying these things.
I wasn't ever off AOL.
I'm not saying these things can't be done. I'm just saying that they are no longer, even in my mind, vaguely obstacles because you have so many great tools out there.
I ever mentioned that I ran a virtual wrestling league on a
PC? Yes, you have.
Okay. Oh, I wasn't sure if I'd ever mentioned that or not.
You have.
With everyone. Like, I'm proud of the terrible things I've done in the past, and I want to tell the entire world.
I kind of am. Have I ever mentioned Greta the Goat? No, Wayne, you haven't, and you're not going to. But
I'm proud of you, Wayne.
Some of the obvious ones that are out there, you know, Mythweavers for keeping track of your character sheets. You've got Map Tools. What's the nuance on
Map Google? Map Tools is the best tool.
Well, what's the nuance on Google Plus now? Is the tabletop?
Google Plus, there's Tabletop Forge.
Tabletop Forge,
and Roll20, both of which have gotten a lot of funding recently and are in the process of upgrading themselves. So they will be even better as time rolls on. The guys who got Tabletop Forge did a Kickstarter. They raised a bunch of money and they started over from scratch with an even better build. And that's supposed to be coming out soon with a lot of changes. Roll20 right now is probably the most sophisticated in terms of features. You know, they all have little quirks that you have to get over. But a lot of people use those tools in conjunction with sometimes other programs on the side that are not running within the Google Plus Hangout framework. There's some of them like Scribd and stuff where you can draw better maps on. And then there's people who use websites like Obsidian Portal to manage their campaign structure.
I use Obsidian Portal.
Yeah, we use Obsidian.
I was going to toss in Obsidian Portal. You've got Wikia if you want to keep
I use Wikia too.
There are tons of ways to keep track of that information. I'll try to link some of these in the show notes, even if I don't get all of them linked or whatever. Don't hesitate to ask on the forums. I know we've got a lot of people that are into online gaming. And quite frankly, a Google search will probably turn up a whole lot more than we've just listed. Out of curiosity, Greg, I'm sure it changes from game to game, but what are the tools that you find yourself repeatedly coming back to when you run your games?
I run a very light tactical game, so I use Tabletop Forge because it's just got a really clean structure for me. I don't need to draw tactical maps to the degree that you might if you're using a more complex system, kind of like I alluded to earlier. But like Roll20 has a much better mapping system built into its structure. But I use Tabletop Forge because I'm really there for rolling dice and drawing kind of a primitive map of like the equivalent of you drawing a doodle on a piece of paper, not a real publishable hardcore map.
Just to get some situational awareness. Wait a minute, we've got this room and there's like 15 people in here. Where the hell is everyone standing?
And there's a hallway that goes this way and there's a door here. You know, like that's really the extent of my mapping needs personally.
Yeah, in my case, that's something we don't even do. We were playing mostly Savage Worlds, not using maps. And if we need to see something, we're just using Skype and we send files back and forth during the course of the Skype conversation. Oh, hey, here's something I just put together in Paint to show you what I'm trying to say. Or here's the PDF.
And sometimes people import in like a map of from Google Maps of like a city. Say you're doing World of Darkness and you could pull in just a satellite map of a city and then make nodes and points on the map and say, this is where so-and-so's haven is. And, you know, draw these each little thing on that map. So you can just bring in a pre-existing image and draw on top of it.
So let me ask you a question, Greg. How many active games do you have running right now? And I'm going to define an active game as a game where you've got a, let's say, at least one session a month and you've had a session of it within the past month.
Right now I'm in one weekly game. Every Saturday night it has seven people in it. It's a D&D chassis game. And then I have previously been up to three weekly campaigns at once. But I haven't played anything with a longer duration than weekly since I started playing online because all the problems that I had that caused me to make biweekly and monthly games don't exist in the online environment. I can play every week. And if I miss a session, there's enough people to pick up the slack that it's not a problem.
Do you always GM or are you a GM and player?
Both. Usually when I'm playtesting my own material, I'll GM it if it's at a state of development where I'm the only one who could do it. Now there's a game that I just released called Ambitions and Avarice that's a D&D retro clone. And I'm having my friend Eric Tankar run that game with a dungeon that I designed. And I'm a player that doesn't have many thoughts. And I have a couple of healing spells and a morning star. And that's the extent of my involvement in the party. Everybody's going ahead and I'm spending most of my time paying attention to how things are working.
So one thing I've noticed with online gaming, I'm curious if you've seen the same thing. I don't see nearly as much metagaming or outside conversations and debates about what to do in an online game as I do with people around the table.
I will agree with that, with the caveat of amongst the players. And I'll get to not amongst the players in a moment. But I will agree with you in saying that my observations lined up with that, that amongst the players, people seem to do a lot less metagaming and a lot less analysis paralysis. People tend to be a little bit more active.
Yeah, the players are usually in character more often.
Wayne, I've noticed the same thing, and I think there are two reasons for that. One, you're not always on. You have more time to kind of think about what it is you would say or do, to half write out and then delete, and then half write out and then delete, until you get the exact right RP thing you want. You're not always being called upon. So when you do declare an action, it's a little bit better thought out. And I think the other reason that there's less metagame and analysis paralysis is you have one pipe. If we're sitting at a table, the GM can be talking to player A, and at the same time, players B, C, and D can be jacking around on the other side of the table. Well, in an online game, you guys are all sitting there in a Google Hangout or on Skype, and it's not to say you couldn't pull up a messenger and have side conversations. We've done it. We've done it sometimes even for game reasons. It's a way of passing secret notes and such.
I do it for game reasons on a regular basis.
But it's not as tempting because of the fact that it takes more attention. You can't just kind of turn to your left and start jacking around. You have to take some effort to do it.
So we typically do a Skype game where all of the role-playing is actually going through voice, and the chat is where anything that is non-game related goes. So the normal conversation where we would just be jacking around, that will go into chat.
Right.
The one-liners, the jokes that we would make around the table that aren't in character, that goes into chat. But also, if we're having like phone conversations between the characters, are doing separate RP roles that would happen but don't have any major impact on the game itself, we use the chat for that as well.
But I'd like to say that sometimes that type of character interaction is important, even if it's technically metagaming. If you all of a sudden hear a really good conversation between the characters, as long as it's in character.
Yeah, if it's in character.
Yeah, if it's in character, through a chat, you wouldn't be able to see that.
I know. In our case, a lot of times it's text messages from the phone. It's not us using phones around the table or anything. It's what we're typing into chat is a text message to the other characters, usually not in a private separate chat room.
Oh, okay.
It's the main chat room.
Yeah, I thought you were saying that you guys would have separate PMs.
And I've played it both ways. I've been in games where they were online games conducted primarily through voice, but I've also been in online games that were conducted entirely through text. For example, John's Goblin game. There was no voice interaction. It was pure text via map tool.
And so, I've changed my style since then. I've started going to Skype. But
That's something I haven't
experienced. Back in the day, I was all typed RP.
I haven't experienced the all typed RP ever. That's something new to me.
It's slower and more deliberate, that's for sure.
Well, and also depending on the speed of the typer, sometimes actions occur asynchronously.
Yeah.
So you get somebody who's two actions ahead of everybody else because of the fact they're just a faster typer. And so the game master kind of keep a handle and say, wait, hold up.
But
this should have occurred way back when. It's just so-and-so is a slow typer.
Getting people who come from an MMO or even a MUD environment into tabletop RPG that way, some of them won't do it any other way. Some of them I'll say, get on Skype and get in your microphone, and they'll go, no, I sound stupid. My husband will laugh at me across the room. I don't want to talk like a goblin.
Oh my gosh.
And I'll be like, okay.
Yeah, I've known people like that too.
Really? I guess I've just never encountered any in our group.
It's kind of cool though, if you are going by text, those big RP moments where you really want, my sentence I'm going to say has to be big.
Yeah.
You've got time to think about it.
That makes complete sense. I get that side of it, I guess, but
And there's also something that you can't have at the table because of physical reality. When you're playing an online game like a Google Hangout, you're looking at the eyes of every other person simultaneously. So if someone's looking at the screen, they're getting eye contact with you when you're speaking.
Yeah, if you've got the cams.
Oh, okay.
I won't do cameras.
You're not just looking at Dan and talking. You're looking at every single person right in the face when you're talking because they're all looking at the same screen.
Wayne, why won't you do a camera?
Because I don't want to be on camera online. I just don't. Like, voice is one thing. I tend to not want to do voice while I'm playing games other than role-playing games. I don't know what it is, but I don't want to have a webcam even in the house.
I don't do cam for two reasons. One, a lot of times, because of the fact that I'm at home, I don't want to be bothered to gussy myself all up. So I could be sitting there 5 o'clock shadow, haven't taken a shower today. I'm not even wearing a shirt.
I have GM'd under all of those conditions. It's really okay.
I've
GM'd without wearing pants.
I'm not saying it's a crime. I'm just saying that
with the camera on,
I have a personal level of dignity that the webcam would violate. The second reason being, and this is really the more, I guess, pragmatic one, is the last time we tried to game with webcams, we had so many people out in the boonies with such crappy internet connections, we could hardly keep even a low codec voice communication going. We had people that kept either breaking up or dropping out of that. If we'd added video on top of that, especially with 6 or 7 people, there's no way. They just could not have handled it.
We have, well, not anymore, but we used to have one of the brothers in our campaigns went to school in Columbia. And so he would Skype in quite often. And yeah, we had that problem all the time where like it would cut out, or he would be like 2 steps behind us, or he'd say something and we all had good internet and it still did it. It's just the nature of it.
Yeah. And a bit of advice there for anyone that's struggling with that. I don't totally understand the architecture. It's been explained to me, but Skype does use a somewhat harsher architecture than like Google or Ventrilo does. So if Skype is not working for you, that doesn't mean voice chat won't work. It may just be that Skype, because of its node system, is choking your connection in a way that something like a Google Hangout would not. So you might want to try something else. All right. So with that covered, I want to start throwing some of the objections that I have historically had, or some of the problems I've historically had with online games, right at Greg, just like we did on Google Plus, and give you the opportunity to respond to these now in front of a broader audience. Let's start off with problem number one. This is an issue that I know John's hit, I've hit: long-term unreliability. Because of the fact...
And short-term unreliability.
Well, unreliability in general. Because of the fact that you don't have the social pressure of having to be at a certain place at a certain time, people are a lot more willing to shoot out an email excuse and not show up for an online game than they are with a face-to-face game. And pretty quickly, you've got players that are making half the games, none of the games.
I find that email excuses are the exception. The norm is just,
they just don't show.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't get your text message, or all your IMs are email. Like, yeah, okay.
And I will add the extra social pressure to skip it. Other people outside of yourself don't take it as seriously as
no one that wants to meet you in person will honor your wishes to not go in person, to stay inside, even if you're playing game.
I agree.
You have to tell them to F off, which can be stressful, but it's possible.
Hold on to that one. That's a slightly different objection. And I have that down here as a different line item.
Okay.
But let's just start off with this. The people, by their own volition, by their own choices, by their own sense of priorities, just don't make it that high of a, to reuse the word priority, to be there. I've seen this a lot. Greg, I threw this one at you. Help me out here. How do you deal with that?
Several things here. First, the person that's at the table has a lot more motivation to be there than in real life for the reasons we've already discussed. You know, they don't have to drive. They're in a game that they want to be in. Not that they agreed on, settled on, they'd play for your benefit. They're really into the game. Second, because of the way that I play games through Google Plus, I talk about role-playing games every day. The people that I regularly interact with that are reliably online, I have a much, much stronger relationship with than somebody that's just random off the street. So if it's somebody that I talk to every day on Google Plus, the odds of them not showing up for a game with no notification at all is much lower. Third, I would say if you're having a lot more people in an online environment, because my games usually run upwards of 6 people, which is really the way, you know, a lot of the game used to be played back in the 80s and 90s before we started getting much smaller groups. So if you have a couple people missing, it's not a big deal when you have 6 people. If you have 2 people missing and you only have 4, then yeah, that's a huge problem.
It could still be a huge problem if that person is either integral to the plot or integral to that moment of the game. For example, we left off on a cliffhanger where Bob was about to decide whether to pull the trigger or not. Has anyone seen Bob? You know, and then Bob never shows up again. And I realize that could happen in a face-to-face game, but it just seems like people do it so much more readily in an online game.
Well, maybe they just feel more obligated to show up, save face.
I haven't seen that as much, because if someone doesn't show up to an online game, we just immediately start harassing them by email and Twitter and everything else for not letting us know ahead of time. I have the same issues with the online games that we do with the physical of work just gets in the way. You know, we have one guy that has a even worse work schedule than I do, and he has a problem with it where work will, at the last minute, they'll give him something, or at the last minute, I'll have something. Sometimes, because it's an online game, I've been able to get around that, where I'll be connected into work with a laptop on the right screen, and I'm gaming on the main screen.
So, Greg, it sounds like, if I'm understanding you right, your suggestions here boil down to, one, get to know the people a little bit ahead of time. You know, try to get a sense from your online interactions how reliable or how invested they are, how emotionally excited they are. But secondly, just persistence, I guess. I don't know. I don't know what you call that one out specifically, but just if you have to turn over 100 people before you find the five that will always show, since you've got such a deep pond to fish from, you can eventually get those five.
I basically did exactly that to get the crew that ran the Goblin game.
See, I'm going to expand it to motivation. Someone who is only gaming online because they can't get to a physical game, they're, I think, a lot more likely to not show up or drop off because this is something that isn't really what they want. It's just giving them a taste of it. People that are into the online game because they're enjoying that game have a different motivation. I think they're more likely to take it seriously.
Yeah, and just to use myself as an example, if my game is at 9 o'clock to midnight, there's very few things that are going to interrupt my schedule at 9 o'clock to midnight compared to if I have to go to a game on Sunday afternoon. On Sunday afternoon, my wife might want to take the kids to the zoo. My parents might need me to come help them do something. You know, I mean, there's all sorts of things that could come up in the middle of the day on Sunday that are not going to come up at all at 9 o'clock to midnight on Thursday.
Yeah, that is a good point. If you can get together and agree to game at a sort of unconventional hour, it's a lot less likely to get interrupted.
I think, John, this was far from the only thing, but I think this is one of the things that your online game struggled with, was the fact that since we had people across so many time zones, we had to pick a relatively central obtrusive time.
I mean, we had one Pacific, two Central, and three Eastern. So I think we started at 7 Central so that the Easterners could get to bed by 1 and so that the Westerner could get home from work.
Yeah.
And just barely. So, yeah, it would have been better if we would have all been in a position where we could say, okay, we're doing it at 8 to midnight local. But
yeah,
had jobs and we all were flung around everywhere in the country.
I always try for 8 because I know I cannot reliably make 7. I can try, and I will try my hardest, but I don't like agreeing to 7 because I know that I can't reliably be home and be ready and be online by then.
My night schedule is so schizo. If I don't have Muni, I can be home at 4 p.m. If I do, I won't be home till 8:30.
Let me move to a related concern, which is one that you guys teased just a few moments ago, which is even if the player respects the time, nobody around them does. You want to get on and you want to play this game, but your spouse, significant other, roommates, whatever, to them, well, he's just sitting in a room with his headphones on, jacking around on the internet. Surely we can come in and talk about how work went, or ask them to clean something real quick, or show them a funny video on YouTube. This is another one that I have seen be a big problem in every online game I'm in, is even when the players themselves are respecting the time, the people around them don't. Because since you're not getting up, putting on your shoes and going out the door to go somewhere, it must not be a real commitment.
Isn't your dog wanting your attention more important than your game?
It ain't my dog that's been the problem.
Well, you're going to have to adjust the quality of the people you marry and stuff like that, Dan. You know what I mean?
Too late.
Come on, man. You got, just to go back to my personal example again, I mean, there's very few things that my wife needs to come get me to help her do at 10 o'clock at night. If there is, she can tell me about it ahead of time. You know, work with them about that. My wife's really happy that I'm not gone for the much longer block of time that I had to go to a real life physical game. I'm there to put the kids down. I'm there to eat dinner. I'm not missing that night.
Is that part of how you look at this, is kind of sales pitch to the other people in your life that, hey, this is less intrusive to you, but at the same time, it is still sacred to me. Your interruptions will not be taken lightly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've had very, very few times where in a game somebody has been really disrupted by things happening in meat space, so to speak. I've had occasions where my kids have been sick and got up coughing or something at 10 o'clock and I have to go deal with that. But that's very rare. It's not something that I see happen for me or anybody that I've been gaming with be a big problem. Most of the people that are really into this, just from a personality perspective, are people who are already spending a huge amount of time on their computer at that time anyway. They're the person who would be playing WoW instead. So instead of playing that, then they're playing this, and that their spouse or whoever respects that.
The worst is when they actually think you are playing WoW. You have to explain, no, I'm not an MMO junkie, but you do have to go away and I have to leave my headphones on.
Well, to them, it's all the same, so it doesn't really matter.
Well, you can break it down, and most people I've encountered will respect social collaborative storytelling roleplay more than they'll respect doing Molten Core again for another purple drop.
But see, in my case, my wife got used to the headphones because I used to do first-person shooter, a clan there. So I was already had headphones and I was talking to people.
Wait, what game did you play?
Wolfenstein Enemy Territory.
Were you actually in like a...
Yeah, we were in a clan.
Cali or Calo?
I can't even remember the ladder we were in now, but we were on a ladder and we did competitions and we were top of the ladder for a while.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Wayne the Nazi killer.
But my wife was used to me, having headphones on and talking to people from that. And before that, it was people from work. We started playing the game and we would talk to each other there. One of the guys never really did that anymore because he put his headphones on once and his wife came in and made fun of him for talking to his work buddies over headphones.
Setting boundaries is, I think, the best way to handle just saying, look, this is what I'm doing for the next several hours. Unless it's an emergency, please don't bother me. Just be happy. I'm home. I'm not out drinking and philandering. But I think...
Well, and let's face it, we've known the people that don't have that boundary when they're at the physical game.
The cell phones are very fair.
They're constantly texting their spouse or whatever, yeah.
The other thing that I think it comes down to is you have to... Well, the other suggestion I have isn't nearly as productive, but I found there's a passive-aggressive thing you can do. Of you have the headphones on whenever somebody talks to you, you pretend like you can't hear them. And then after they say it two or three times, you then take the headphones off and go, what? And you make them repeat it again. And usually they get so freaking sick of repeating themselves, that they just stop leave. Doing it.
Well, I mean, in what we've done, well, by we, I mean, I live with my boyfriend and my brother, and we're all gamers. So what we do is, like, if it's something important enough, we'll just write a note, stick it in front of them, and leave. And then if it's important enough to them that they need to get off their game to come handle it, then they do. You know, we'll leave it up to the discretion of them.
Let me throw out two more objections, and these kind of like the first two are also related. And I'm going to broadly put these under distractions. We talked about family or the house being a distraction, but that's not the only distraction in front of you. You're sitting at a computer. If you're not the center of action right now, it's very tempting to Alt-Tab to check an email, or to read a forum, or to check your favorite news site, or whatever. And this has been another major problem I've seen derail a lot of games, is when the spotlight is not on someone, they start to stray a bit too far, special thanks to Alt-Tab, that by the time you need them again, they have no idea what's been occurring for the past 15 minutes.
A lot of that is choosing the right game. There's going to be certain games that are harder to play without making people distracted. If you're playing a game with 10-minute combat rounds in real life, real time, it takes forever to go around the table and get everybody's action. It takes forever to adjudicate everything. That's definitely going to be ripe for people getting distracted and running off. But if you have a game where you say, I attack him, I roll one die, my action's over, then that will go through a lot faster. And that's why I play a lot of the old school Renaissance games where it's like it's D&D, but it's really, really fast and light adjudication. Or you play some of the story games where it's very simple die mechanics. You don't want to get bogged down in a 15-minute interaction between one player and the GM. You want to have things be basically taken care of. And that keeps people right there.
That's very sound advice, but rules aren't the only place where that can happen. If you get a role-playing situation where two people are talking to the king and the other three aren't because they chose to stay out of the room for whatever reason, you really kind of end up with the exact same situation.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see that happening. I think a lot of it would be coming down to a play style issue that you might want to focus on bringing things to be faster rather than having a long time where one person's being taken care of. But even when you do have a time period, let's say there's a 15-minute block where I know that you're going to be hacking the Matrix, and my character is not going to be taking care of that. It's just sitting on the sidelines. So I go off and do something else. It's kind of like the principle of going around the business world of people who take short little breaks in the middle of their workday rather than one long break, take a bunch of little short breaks, are much more active and paying attention at their job. So it's that kind of same principle. It's a nice little break from me from that. I can clear my head for a second, check up on some other things, take care of those things that might take me away from the table when I need to be there.
The related one that I've run into is the tools themselves become a distraction. I remember in our most recent aborted attempt at an online D&D game, or was it actually, I think it was actually a Pathfinder game. It's a Pathfinder game. We had people who, quite frankly, were so busy either trying to figure out all the little nuts and bolts of the tools, or were using them to try and be funny by changing their chat aliases or dropping giant monsters in the middle of the battlefield.
We were hilarious.
And the tools themselves became the problem, where it's kind of like, you know, I almost wish we just had no play surface. And you know, it really is starting to sound like that A, picking the right people, and B, being just a little bit of a dick, both to your players and to your cohabitators in the real world, is what solves most of these problems. And maybe that's where I kind of dropped the balls. Maybe I should have been a slightly bigger dick to the players. Like, guys, stay on topic, pay attention, stop changing your chat aliases, or get out.
I mean, yeah, they would have just gotten out.
I know.
They did anyway.
And you're playing with somebody that you know really well in real life, you know, like your group that you're in right now at the table. You don't really want to offend the other people too much. You're playing a social game, trying to maintain a good face. You want them to like you. You want all this stuff. If you're looking at one person who you had extra slots for this game, other people who wanted to be there, this person won't cooperate. Just kick them. Don't worry about it. It doesn't bother you.
Well, and on the other side of that, I feel like whenever you're talking to people online who you've never known before, they tend to be a little bit more apt to talk up more and pay attention because they want to make a good impression.
Yeah.
You're always meeting new people.
Yeah, and it's perhaps easier to speak with candor when you're among a group of online people who you may have only chatted with about RPGs over the internet, as opposed to, you know, okay, I'm going out to lunch with him on Tuesday, I'm going to his kids' concert on Friday. I don't really want to drop the hammer on the RPG, even if the game needs it.
Yeah, I would say if the tool's actually a problem, either lock it down, because if I remember correctly, there was a way you could lock that down where other people couldn't throw in monsters.
Some of them I couldn't. It varied from tool to tool.
In our case, we don't even use an online die roller. We enjoy the visceral feel of rolling dice, and we're all friends and trust each other.
And the visceral feel of lying about getting 20s.
Yeah, you gotta be careful about that.
we're all friends and trust each other enough that we that we believe that we won't do that. If someone does, oh well.
I would love to see a scatter sampled average of your roll results.
You would see that I roll really badly.
Well, I believe roll terribly. Good-hearted ginger.
There are some,
but your friends I don't trust.
There are individuals I trust more than others. I will certainly say that. Actually, I guess within my current circle of gamers, there's no one that I would call an outright cheater. Now, would somebody, when they really care, be tempted to fudge or reroll one die? I'm sure that's the case. But there's no one I'm game with currently who I just say, like, outright point at and say, wow, that's a cheater. I have in the past.
Yeah, they have been in groups that we have both been in, Dan. None of them are in any groups that we're in together now.
Well, I think it depends on the game you're playing, too. Like, as much as I love the feel of the actual dice and rolling them, I wouldn't want to do that in a game like D&D. But for the games that we play, which are tend to be Savage Worlds based, it's not as big of a deal. We don't have as many combats. It's a lot more just making a check against this or that. And you know,
I think the narrative has a lot more credibility and cohesion, especially from the GM's chair. If all the roles are random and above the table, I never use a screen, whether I'm online or in person. I use a random number generator where everyone can see it. And then when I say, okay, that orc just critted you and took your head off, it's sitting right there.
One thing that I want to talk about is how a lot of times when you're creating a physical group, you have people that come from really wildly different expectations and style standpoints. And when you are able to recruit an online group based on interest, you can pick people who only really want to play in that particular manner. And I drew, before we came on here, two distinctions here. One between player-oriented versus GM-oriented campaign structure. Some people want a powerful GM who has a really strong idea of where they want things to go, and other people want to have all the players be really invested and highly involved and have a lot of ideas. So when you have that one person at the table who doesn't seem to really be putting up a lot of ideas as a player, that person really needs to be in a GM-oriented campaign. They don't need to be in the game where all the players are providing all this extra campaign structure. They need to find a game that fits with them. Another distinction is between traditional and narrative mechanics. A lot of people want to use traditional D&D style mechanics where the dice determine what event is successful or not in the real world. And some people want to use narrative mechanics where the dice just determine who gets to narrate what happened in the world. There's a lot of different games out there that fall into those two different categories, play styles that can, even within the same game, you can be playing Pathfinder and have somebody who's very player oriented and sandboxy, and another person who's very GM story, heavy narrative structure in the way that the GM wants things to be presented. So
I sometimes feel odd that I love both styles. I love playing in both kinds of games. I have no problem running either kind. I always feel a little weird about that because it does seem to be like camps sometimes. You have the camp that falls on one side and the camp that falls on the other. For me, it's more important that I'm playing with my friends. That's what I want, is I want to play with the people that I enjoy playing with. So I can enjoy either one. And I do enjoy both styles quite a bit.
I personally play to see how the game works. I like to play new systems. I like to see new things. I like how this mechanic works. I like how this narrative structure works. So I'm very open-minded on that. But I've played in several games where somebody who's sitting there really quiet the whole time because the game design is just not really their cup of tea. And that's fine. We can get that person into another group, and they can be highly involved in that group. Played a game of The One Ring, which is very Tolkien and heavy story, and trying to not be as armed homeless people like in D&D. And it's very different styles. If you don't fit into that, and you don't want to be a hobbit who sits around and smokes on pipeweed and discusses theory of history, then that might not be the game for you. You know, if you're really...
I've never played a game like that, but I want to.
I would do it. I would totally do that.
That's one of the things I love about the
Shire
One
Politics.
Being a smoker is actually a part of your player structure if you choose it as an advantage. So there's all sorts of different games out there. There's tons of different games. Find a game that works for you. Find the people who really want to play it in the way that you want to play it, and go with that. You've had Stuart Robertson on the show. He has a thing on his blog, which I sent you the link for the show notes, about GM merit badges. These are little icons if you're recruiting people for a campaign that describe what's important to you about the game. Like one, the first one is tactics are an important part of my game. So if you put that on your recruit thread, and you know, people know going in that they're going to be fighting on a grid and it's going to be heavy tactical, whether it's, you know, fourth edition D&D or some kind of wargaming type setup, then they're going to be buying into that right ahead of time. They're going to know what they're getting into. There's badges for like my game will be scary. So if somebody is not really into horror, they shouldn't get into that game. There's things like, I will kill players, I won't. My games are gonzo. My games are very heroic. They have disturbing content. All these different kinds of aspects of what your game in particular is going to be about. So people who sign up to be in that game are really on board with that style.
Question is, what would you say to someone like me who, the idea of playing with strangers or recruiting people to a game, that doesn't appeal to me at all. It's a social thing.
You came and joined these guys. You didn't have any idea what you were doing. You were like, I'm going to play this Skies of Glass thing, man. And you totally signed up. You are an adventurous person, Wayne. You're just lying to yourself right now.
Yes!
I at least knew one person at the table, though. And
believe in yourself.
I was very nervous because I didn't know anyone else. I knew the one person, and that was it.
The question that I would have to close this out on is, so where do you start? Let's say you're someone who's not currently tapped into any of this online game stuff, or maybe you've tried a few in the past, whether it's play by post or live play or whatever, and it just hasn't gone too well. Where do you go to get started? How do you find these people? How do you set up the games?
I would say make a Google Plus account. Start looking around. The great thing about Google Plus is that it's designed to put you in contact with people who have the same interest as you that you don't know right now. Facebook is great for finding people that you already know. But if you start adding people you don't know, Facebook breaks. If you start using Twitter for complex conversations, it breaks. Google Plus is designed exactly the way it needs to be in order to play online RPGs. You can have people who've shared circles. You can just do a Google search through Google Plus for people who've shared circles of RPG gamers. This is the ability of you to just take like 500 people at once and add them to your stream. So you can immediately hook into these people that are talking about RPGs. Look for people who are talking about them in the same way that you like to play. Talk about aspects of what you play at the table. Pay attention to what people say about what they do at the table. Find people that are really like you. There's a ton of people. I have over 7,500 people that are connected to me on Google+. There's tons of people out there that are playing games I will never play because they just don't appeal to me. But I'm connected to those people. I can see what they're talking about role-playing games. I can see what they're doing. And then I have a kind of a situational awareness of what's going on. I can find people in their conversations that are like me that are arguing with them. Keep a very open mind. Try to talk to as many people as you can and build up an idea of who's like you. And once you find a person with several thousand people that are connected to them that are very similar to you, talk to that person personally in PM or email or whatever and say, look, this is what I'm really looking to get into. How can I do it? If you came to me and you said, I'm trying to recruit people for this particular type of game, I could shoot out 10 names right away. So you got to talk to these people. Find somebody who's connected. They can help you. It's really it. It's networking. You got to start on the ground floor and talk to a lot of people.
I found it interesting that you went straight to Google+ instead of the usual device, which is this or that forum. Do you think because of its reach, Google+ is maybe better than a forum in that regard? Yeah. That it's better to go there than EN World or RPGNet or whatever?
Definitely. And the problem with the RPG forums is that they become highly politicized. You have to deal with a lot of people that you don't like, that are abrasive, that are problematic, that just happen to be favored by the moderators, whatever it is. If I'm on Google+ and you're being an ass, I can just block you. You disappear forever. You know, I mean, there's no problem. So it's very personalized in the same way that blogging allows you to have a different kind of a reputation of yourself online, a different way of interacting with people that's much more respectful.
Well, Greg, I want to thank you once again for joining us. This has been a very interesting conversation.
No problem.
And for you guys at home, as always, check the show notes. I will link to a bunch of stuff, including stuff for the postcards contest, as well as some of the things that we talked about on this show. I'll also be linking to Greg Christopher's Google+ account. So if you're interested in checking him out over there, then be sure to track him down and see what this man has to say, because I can assure you it's some good stuff. And beyond that, have a great week and great games, and we will catch you guys next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2012. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.